Very little of the castle was habitable, but it was enough for herself and Ping, and for the aged retainer who seemed molded into the place. We had scones and strawberry jam with big mugs of strong Indian tea, sitting in the kitchen with Maggie, the retainer, hovering in the background, and grumbling all the while under her breath about her legs. The kitchen was huge and vaulted, the flagstone floor worn by the passage of years and booted feet. The big black kettle that was used to boil water for our tea hung on a hook over the great open fire. There must surely have been a man about the place, for there was an enormous pile of logs stacked up beside the fireplace. I admired the table, although it was a puzzle to me, and she explained that her late husband had made it himself out of one of the stout old doors of the castle, saving it from decay. She showed me exactly where the hinges had been, and told how he had found 6 carved and claw-footed legs in a second-hand shop in Dublin and had lovingly made the hole into a table. She went on to tell me that he had been educated at Stonyhurst, one of the 2 important Catholic public schools in England, but the family had had to scrape the bottom of the barrel in order to educate him. He was a dreamer, she said with a shrug. If she thought his education was a waste, she gave no indication of it. After tea we went out to inspect the garden. At one time it must have been quite beautiful, and its situation was breathtaking, the gentle rolling hills in the distance, the soft mist and the feeling of isolation and peace. She told me that her mother-in-law had been a keen gardener, but she was English, which seemed to sum it all up. Now the garden, like the house, had fallen into neglect, and the unkempt grazing land beyond had encroached upon it. The Shane property in Dublin in which we lived was similarly in need of repair, a fact which was a cause of annoyance to the Rampers, although not in the least disturbing to me. Unlike myself, the aesthetic side of accommodation meant little to them mainly, I imagine, because they had been forced to live in substandard places through lack of money for too long. The flat we occupied comprised the top floor of the building in what I can only describe as a mezzanine, a single room which jutted out halfway up the stairs between the first and top floors of the place. This room was allotted to me, and I was charmed by it. On the ground floor was a florist's shop, so there was always the welcome of cheerful colors and exotic scents when returning home from shopping or anything else. Climbing the narrow, rickety staircase, one had to pass the tailor's establishment on the first floor before reaching my room halfway up the next flight. The tailor was a genial enough fellow, his only failing being a predilection for bacon and sausage, which comprised his daily lunch menu to judge by the aroma wafted up the stairs. But it is true, and must be said, there are worse things than bacon and sausage for lunch. Lady Shane rode her bicycle into Dublin to collect rent from us all regularly. She would arrive dressed in warm ancient tweeds, sturdy sensible shoes and stockings, and a felt hat rammed on her head and secured by 2 hatpins, lethal-looking weapons, to combat the winds. Her ruddy, weather-worn cheeks and glowing nose were proof of her stalwart open-air life. If it was wet, as it frequently was, although a friendly type of rain bestowing only health and beauty, she wore an all-enveloping Macintosh, and had had another cut for Ping from a discarded, older Macintosh. I had never, at that time, seen a dog so attired, although it is common now, even rain boot tees these days, and I found it absurd and amusing to see his cross little face staring out from under the cover of his hooded rain gear. The advertisement for the flat had been so brief that no one could accuse it of being misleading, and, in any case, everyone has a conflicting idea of what furnished means. I can only say it was sparsely furnished, and what there was not exactly pristine. However, it was tasteful and evoked a past era. I personally like old rugs even if they do smell rather of camels. I find big antiquated chairs comforting and pleasing, and I especially like old-looking glasses. They are shameless flatterers. What perhaps upset Chen and Rab most was that nearly all the plates, cups, saucers, everything, in fact, used for cooking and eating, was chipped, cracked, or warped in one way or another. They felt it was unhealthy and they found themselves obliged to buy new. It was incomprehensible to Lady Shane, causing her to see us as slightly mad. The flat was situated right across the street from the grounds of Trinity College, and Chen found great pleasure in the library, not open to the public, but he obtained a reader's pass to allow him the privilege of studying there whenever he pleased. The big windows upstairs looked out over the university grounds. My mezzanine room had a long window to the floor with a flat roof outside. It was at the back of the building, and the flat roof was almost enclosed by two walls, the backs of other buildings. It gave to my room a cozy and private feeling. Early in the morning, as the first hints of dawn streaked across the sky, the seagulls would arrive and I would waken to their clawed feet, pitter-pat, pitter-pat, on the concrete roof as they sought out whatever prey the night-prowling felines had left over from their excursions. A gull would grab a morsel, fight over it with others who had alighted as if summoned by telepathy, and the winner would rise in flight triumphantly with the others, screaming their primordial cry, in pursuit. I loved to hear the seagulls, the wildness of them, their freedom, and in a certain way I envied them. A little later on, one would hear the clanging of church bells, calling the faithful to begin their day in piety, and then from somewhere nearby the sonorous chimes of a clock giving the hour, the quarter, the half or three quarters. It all wove into a pattern, became habitual, the start of a new day in a new life. Life in Dublin was good. The Irish people had suffered great hardship and deprivation for centuries, and even now lived under the yoke of their religion, but somehow it had refined them and given a depth of understanding which a newcomer could pick up and appreciate. We all felt comfortable there. It must have been around that time that I first became aware that Chen's work with the aura was actually rather more than the perfecting of a machine to view the aura for the medical profession. But I was not to fully realize the implications until much later. I was still at that time very much a novice in matters pertaining to higher esoteric lore. Quite shortly after we moved to Dublin, Chen and Rab started to discuss finding models for auric photography. Apparently, the female aura is generally brighter than the male, the colors stronger, and so it was necessary to find women willing to pose nude. Rab's view was that it would be virtually impossible. She saw the young Catholic women as being overly modest, and hesitated to even make inquiries. Chen, with a deeper knowledge of human nature, saw no such difficulty. What about the girl in the flower shop? I imagine her pay is minimal. Doesn't she have a child to support? Ask her. There's no harm in asking. I'm willing to wager she'll be glad to have extra money. He was right. As it turned out, there was no shortage of models, nice girls for the most part who needed a little extra money. The photographic equipment required was also in supply, and he began to develop and print his own material when he was not using Polaroid cameras. We set up the bathroom as a dark room, and woe betide anyone who opened the door at the wrong moment and wrecked a film. He was keen for me to take up photography, and showed me how to use quite complicated equipment. In those days it was more of a skill to use any kind of camera. Cameras such as we were using were not automatic, they were for the most part designed for expert professional use, and it was necessary to use light meters and many different lenses. In his work he was making long exposures, so there were tripods and lights around for my use at all times. It was a hobby for me, and truthfully rather an enforced one. Not something I ever became passionate about, but I did learn about different cameras, from minute spy cameras like the Garmin Minox, to large format cameras used by some of the wonderful original photographers, to the Hasselblad and modern Japanese cameras. And then to sign photography. My feeling is that Chen did make progress at that time, but he had no luck in obtaining specially sensitized film, which was what he really needed. The demand was not large enough for it to be a proposition for the big manufacturers. As well as photography, he began writing another book. Rab and I would leave him alone for a couple of hours or so daily in order that he could dictate without fear of interruption. Often we would go out for dinner, although there were relatively few restaurants at that time in Dublin. Powers Hotel on the corner near to us was a favorite for their excellent soda bread and good plain food. The next day I would transcribe the tape using a Philips machine and a manual Olympia typewriter, alone in my mezzanine room. It was fascinating. I sat there with a padded headset, listening, transcribing what I heard, often lost in the work. He dictated very clearly, never hesitating or backtracking. It was easy to type from his dictation, and he very seldom, in fact almost never, altered anything once he had dictated it. In our daily life we were not in the least intense. Contrary to press reports and similar, we never had groups or individuals for any form of psychic activity. We did not engage as a group in meditation, yoga or other extrasensory activities. Chen was the antithesis of a cultist. Naturally, he would perhaps uncover his crystal for some reason. Normally it was kept on a stand covered with a square of black velvet, or he might ask us not to speak for a few minutes while he received a telepathic message, things like that. But in general, we discussed photography, Ireland, cats, the latest news, world events, subjects any reasonably intelligent people might discuss. So to be transcribing this highly intense material was a privilege. It is true, as has been pointed out by those who enjoy criticism, that Chen had a perfect command of the English language, too perfect, they thought, for a Tibetan. It has also been said that his spoken English was that of a North Country Englishman, a South Country Englishman, a Londoner, and so on. But that is untrue. The fact of such a variety of opinions invalidates them anyway. It was not possible to place him from his manner of speech. The only deviation that I noticed, and teased him about, was that he would say Boughton instead of Bought occasionally. Since he could not hear, I always assumed that he had learned to speak the language from patterns he saw or felt. His spoken English transcended class and was intelligible to everyone. The problem is that normal, non-psychic people do not understand psychic ability, so we naturally judge the world by normal non-psychic standards. Our standards, though, are quite limited to a psychic who is endowed with much greater ability. Chen was as a sighted man in the land of the blind. How to explain to a normal person not endowed with psychic ability that he could learn a language from patterns and speak it as a native? Impossible, one cannot. There are many psychic phenomena which are unexplainable in concrete language because there are no terms of reference. Those things have either to be taken on trust until one's inner self reaches realization, as happens, or one can simply keep an open mind. Regrettably, many choose to disbelieve because they are unable to take anything on trust or to keep an open mind. That is perhaps why, despite his inner peace, Chen could still feel lonely and often did. At times, even, he felt miserable because he was misunderstood and very much alone. He was necessarily subject to lesser qualities, as we have to be in order to stay on this earth. He never professed to be a saint. Even now I can almost hear his voice saying, "So many times did I hear it, the middle way is the only way. If you are too good you can't remain here, and it's never a good idea to be too bad, it catches up on you." One of his failings and one which worked against him was hypersensitivity. He could take offense where none was intended. A good example and one which comes to mind is that of a famous American writer, a deep thinker, who had written in praise of the third eye. At some point in their exchange of letters he had remarked that Chen was not religious. It was clearly a perceptive observation, a compliment meaning that he was above religion. His form of Buddhism was a way of life, not a religion. Sadly, however, he took offense and terminated the correspondence abruptly and without explanation. "Chen, I'm so sorry, I can't wear a watch, they never go on me. Have you ever tried a gold one?" "No." "Well, try this one, I think it will work. These mornings of my old age, so long after, sometimes I waken with thoughts or words in my mind, and I am taken back to that life, those years I lived with the Rampas. It is as if time is non-existent. In my mind I am there again for a brief moment, that moment between sleep and wakefulness." "The watch? The old gold watch?" "Yes, I still have it. It still tells the time, it is still a treasured possession and, as he knew it would, it did keep time on my wrist as no other watch I had attempted to wear had done previously. When we lived in Dublin we would sometimes rent a car for the day. We never drove too far afield, there was no need to, You could be out of the city in a matter of 10 minutes or so. We would sometimes go up to the Wicklow Mountains, soft, mellow country, watercolor country, expressionistic with forms and colors melting into each other. At other times we would go along the coast, south to Dunlow Glare where the boats from Liverpool docked. Or we might go the other way to Sutton Cross and on to Howth, a large fishing village with the Bailey Lighthouse on the point, mournfully wailing through the fog and flashing its light to alert sailors of their bearings, and warn of the rocky waters and their close proximity to land. It was one of those days that Chen En Rab had decided to take a ride with QI and I had elected to stay at home because I had plenty to do, letters to type as well as the book, and I hated to get behind with my work. It seemed they had been gone almost no time at all, or was it really that I was absorbed in what I was doing, when I heard them going up the stairs past my door, QI with her Siamese cat voice telling the world she was glad to be home but she had had a splendid outing, Rab asking her to be quiet, and then Chen strode on the stair. The others went on, but he stopped outside my door and gently knocked. May I come in? I got up, glad to see him. But of course. I turned my chair around so he could sit down. It was a firm chair, one I used for typing and quite comfortable for him for short periods of time. I sat on my bed, plumping up the pillows to make a cushion. Thank you, but I won't stay for long. He felt in his pocket and brought out a small black box. As he handed it to me, he said, "You've been working too hard, you need a change. But here's a little present until such time as we can get the book done and take a rest and a holiday." I took the box and opened it. The nestling in the bed of green silk was a little gold watch. It was quite delightful. Without even lifting it out of the box I could tell it was old. The gold had that warm, reddish hue, and the face was clear and simple. Old things speak to one, and I instantly felt that the little watch was just right. But I was dismayed. "Chen, I'm so sorry, I can't wear a watch, they never go on me." I was confused, not wishing to appear ungrateful, yet not wishing to accept something I felt unable to use. "Have you ever tried a gold one?" he asked. "No." "Well, try this one. I think it will work." He smiled, seeing that I really loved the watch, as I took it out and held it in my hand. "Here, let's see if it's the right size for you." He fastened the gold bracelet on my left wrist, and it was a perfect fit, just enough room for movement. He removed it again and compared the time with his own watch, setting the hands correctly and carefully winding it up. As he did so, he took the chair I had offered him, after all, and said, "It's a pity you can't do psychometry, you'd find it interesting, especially as you like old things so much." "What do you mean by psychometry, Chen?" I was indeed interested. "Well, someone who is psychic or sensitive can hold an object in their hand, and by letting the mind go blank the subconscious can activate paranormal senses so that the fingers can convey vibrations to the brain which form pictures. As I've told you many times," he continued, seeing I was listening intently, "all life is electric and magnetic, and anything that has been touched by a person always has the mark, or impression, of that person in future. It's like touching a piece of iron with a magnet, you partly magnetize that piece of iron. A galvanometer or a magnetic compass can detect the magnetism imparted to the iron. Do you follow?"
"Yes, I think so."
"You mean you're like the compass, in a way, when you do psychometry, you can detect the impressions."
"That's right.
I can hold your watch in my hand like this." He had the watch resting in the palm of his hand as he spoke, "and by letting my mind go blank I can see pictures of events in the life of this object." He closed his eyes, and sat silent for a few minutes. I hardly dared to breathe. I wanted to know about the little watch, and was afraid of putting him off the track. Presently he spoke, still with his eyes closed. "Yes, it belonged to a very elegant woman, French probably, or perhaps Italian, dark-haired. She wore the watch constantly, valued it highly. When she was dying she gave it to another woman close to her, perhaps a servant or a nurse, someone she was rewarding,
or thanking. The watch was put away for quite a long time. The other woman never wore it. He stopped speaking, but after a pause continued, I can't get anything else just now.
Oh, but that's fascinating. I was delighted. I was determined to wear this watch, and see that it worked on my wrist. Perhaps in time I, too, would be able to see its past.
He handed it back to me and I fastened the clasp securely. I knew it was right for me.
Thank you so much, Chen, it's so very kind and thoughtful of you.
I shall value it as greatly as the woman you described, the original owner.
I was sincere in my gratitude.
Well, we're going to have tea now, so why don't you come upstairs and put your work away?
Rab's got the kettle on, I think.
He rose stiffly, rubbing his back.
I've been sitting too long in the car.
Right, I said, I'll put my things away and be up in a few minutes.
Rab was in the kitchen making the tea by the time I had tidied up and climbed the stairs.
I went through to tell her about the watch and show her how it looked.
Oh, she greeted me, Chen's in the bathroom but the tea's almost ready.
Did you remember to get the rich tea biscuits?
I can't find them.
Goodness, no, I completely forgot.
Sorry, can we have something else?
She looked annoyed.
No, you know he likes rich tea.
What a nuisance.
Anyway, what is it?
I just wanted to show you the watch.
Look how beautiful it is, Rab.
I held out my wrist, but she barely glanced at it.
It's just an old one. Probably won't keep time, she remarked.
You mustn't get the idea that you're special just because he gave you a watch, you know.
He's always giving people things.
And besides, the truth is you're not special.
She reached into the cupboard for cups and saucers, then banged them down on the tray.
And another thing, you're going to have to change the way you talk if you're going to stay with us.
No one can understand what you're talking about. You sound as if you think you're superior or something,
affected.
Yes, that's it, affected.
She poured milk into the jug and picked up the tray.
I'm only telling you for your own good.
Come along, then, and have some tea.
We'll have to do without biscuits, but Chen won't like it.
I followed her into the big room and sat down in my usual place.
What a mean old cow.
She acted like a deluge of cold water on one's enthusiasms sometimes.
QI likes that chair, you know, it's really hers.
Rab told me as she passed my tea.
Yes, I know, but she prefers anyone's lap, especially Chen's.
I had no intention of moving until I was ready any more than I was prepared to change the way I talked.
I think I'll go for a walk this evening and perhaps see a picture if there's anything good on, I said.
So I'll skip supper. You can't go alone, Chen told me.
It doesn't look good.
Strangely, when it concerned me, he was always more worried about appearances than I ever was or could be, but there was no reason to upset him.
Oh well, I'll just go for a walk then, and early bed.
I drank my tea, then rose to leave.
Thank you again so much for the beautiful present.
I love it and she'll wear it most of the time. And, so far, it's ticking away and keeping time.
It seems to me that watches have always stopped on me before. No matter what, I think you'll find it works all right.
Timepieces are very engaging things, you know, personalities in a way.
He smiled.
Good night, then.
Rab sniffed disdainfully.
I was becoming accustomed to her moods.
It was easier for me than for Chen, which was some consolation.
So far as I recall, it was early autumn, and by the time I left the flat for my walk it was dusk.
It would be around 6 o'clock, I imagine.
I can remember London extremely well, although it is years since I last visited that city, but I remember Dublin only sketchily, that is to say the street names escape me, and the distances between different locations.
We lived in Nassau Street, I do remember that one.
And it could not have been too far from the center of the city because I remember walking to the post office that evening, and I would say the post office represented the center of the city, a large imposing building where reportedly a handful of gallant Irish had held off the British in the times of the Troubles.
It has never been forgotten, and probably never will be.
The river Liffey flows nearby, and I was standing looking at the bleak, grey, waters, and idly wondering to myself how suicides had the courage to jump to their death, when I heard my name being called. I turned around, startled, and saw an old friend, Julian Chalmers, approaching with long strides from the other side of the street. "Well, well, it is you, Sheila. What on earth are you doing here all alone in the moonlight?" Julian had been my first beau when I was 16, and although I seldom ran into him since my marriage, we had one of those firm friendships that do not require constant meetings. I was more than delighted to see him that evening. It turned out that he was on leave, his regiment just having returned from overseas, and he was out of touch, as he put it, and had heard nothing about my upheavals. My impression was that he was somewhat appalled when I told him I was virtually on my own, but he was, and had always been, exquisitely courteous and diplomatic. Taking me by the elbow, he said, "Now, come along, old girl, let's toddle off and get a drink. You look as though you need one. You don't look so chipper, I have to say, although still, of course, your own beautiful self." Julian clearly was no stranger to Dublin. As we walked along together, I remembered him telling about his childhood in Ireland, now I came to think of it, miles away on the west coast somewhere. "Galway," he said, "my mother's there, father died a few years ago. I'm on my way to see the old sport, spend a few days before going back to London. I inherited the place, of course, so there are things to see to."
"Is it a castle, Julian?"
"A castle? No, I wouldn't say so. Do you like castles or something?" "It's a big old Georgian pile. Pretty, but takes a hell of a lot to maintain. Why don't you run down there with me? It'd be awfully jolly. It'd do you good." In no time at all we were cozily ensconced in some smart bar below street level. I had been past the place dozens of times without really noticing the door we entered now, it was so nondescript. Just a brown door. Once over the threshold, however, and down a few steps, the atmosphere was welcoming and elegant, unlike anything I had been accustomed to in my short time in Dublin. Julian insisted on ordering a bottle of bubbly to set you right, and I offered no resistance. He was a charming companion, relaxed, amusing and attentive, and before long the champagne was doing its work. Someone was playing a piano. Gentle swing music. The talk around us was restrained, the lights were low without being too dim, and I began to feel happy and entirely at home. I started to tell him about Chen, and I must have run on and opened up to an alarming degree, but he was, after all, a very old friend and easy to talk to. We had a lot in common, we had grown up with the same values and appreciations. Like John, he was my senior by a number of years. Both of them had been through the war, both had seen frontline fighting, but neither spoke about it. It had given them, though, an intangible strength or maturity that the rest of us lacked. He let me talk on for a while, all the time twirling his mustache and nodding, encouraging my confidence. Then he leant across the table purposefully and said, "You must have got religion or something, you know. I think you should calm down, old girl. It all sounds pretty weird to me."
"Don't be ridiculous, Julian.
You know very well I'm opposed to religion, all that fighting and hatred and pretending it's all so saintly. Remember John's mother and the trouble I had with her? Her telling everyone I was a heathen."
"Yes, I know, but this esoteric stuff, well, it isn't logical, you know, it's all a load of hocus pocus, nothing scientific about it. You can't prove any of it, it's all just imagination.
I'm surprised you let yourself get sucked in. I bet you this fellow you're so full of is a fraud. I'm only telling you for your own good before it's too late. You can still go back to John and patch things up. You shouldn't get involved in all this nonsense." He looked at me earnestly, entirely convinced of the rightness and validity of his opinion. "Good God, Julian. You're the second person today telling me things for my supposed own good. You simply don't understand, you're a soldier, you have no vision, everything in your world is black or white, no grey areas. But in reality, You know, it's all grey. My dear old thing, if it weren't for soldiers you'd be under the Nazis at this very moment.